Welcome to The Sync Report, the intersection between filmmakers, content creators, and musicians, where we host a weekly conversation with some of the biggest names in film, television, music, and entertainment. Meet industry experts and top-level musicians as we pull the curtain back on music placement and scores, building vital relationships and providing real opportunities for our listeners. Listen to indie filmmakers and content creators present their latest productions and describe specific scenes as they consider music submitted by our audience. Hosted by film star and musician Colin O'Donoghue and his co-host, the godmother of independent films, Rose Ganguza, and The Sync Report's creator and music supervisor, Jason P. Rothwell. Don't forget, tell your friends about us and remember to rate, comment and subscribe to The Sync Report on Apple and across all platforms. Music is the difference between a good film and a great one.
Welcome to The Sync Report.
Thank you, Milfredo and Willow, for that lovely introduction, and welcome to The Sync Report.
With Every Beat of My Heart, written by our guest tonight, Tommy. Welcome to The Sync Report. Thank you for joining us. How are you today?
I'm doing great, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, what a buzz. I mean, Tommy, I've known you for a while now. You know, you've worked with my wife. You worked with Stephanie Rainey. You've done everything I could bring to you. You've accepted. And, you know, now I'm going through your credits. I'm like, why does this guy pick up the phone to me? Let's start. You're a California boy. You're born in Redlands, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I grew up in Redlands. It's about 60 miles east of Los Angeles.
And you're born into a very musical family. I mean, tell me, were your parents? I know your brothers are all musicians as well. But were you influenced by your parents?
Oh yeah, my mom was a great pianist and a singer. You know, she'd walk around the house singing Stormy Weather and things like that. And my older brothers had band rehearsals in our living room every Sunday afternoon, as far back as I could remember. So, you know, it was just a part of our everyday existence. My brothers had a band. They were doing Dixieland and jazz. They used to play high school proms. And so we had horns in our living room from the time that I was like 4 years old. I remember my brother playing the trombone and you know, playing music was just a part of our every day, you know. All the kids, and if there were 8 kids in our family, and we all took piano lessons. So my mom would have us all sit at the piano and learn how to sing harmonies. And basically, music was just like totally accepted and always a part of our lives.
Incredible. So are you the youngest of the brothers then?
No, I'm right in the middle. My brother Davey, he plays bass with Elvis Costello. He's been playing with Elvis for the last 15 years.
Oh God!
And you know, everybody in my family still plays. So we get together occasionally. Every birthday party is always a jam session.
So your brothers form a band.
Farrah and Brothers, yeah.
And they're, you know, they're doing quite well. And then you joined the band at what age?
I was 18. And, you know, so Davey and I had our own band. I was writing with this guy and we were doing a duet and we started writing songs when I was about 13. Meanwhile, my older brothers had a group called the Peppermint Trolley Company. And they were doing TV shows. They did American Bandstand. They were on the Beverly Hillbillies. They were on a TV show called Mannix. And so, you know, it was a great charge for us to turn the TV on and see our brothers on TV. We felt like we had a place in the music business from a very early point. And so Davey and I had a band together. Davey wanted to play drums, and we had a drummer who owned the PA, and we needed a bass player. So we got Davey a bass, and within 2 weeks, he was already playing Motown bass parts, and we were like blown away. So, you know, that's kind of the start of it all for him. And my older brothers had a group. They were signed to Richard Perry. They had changed their name to Bones, and they had done two albums through Richard Perry's production company. And they broke up, and Davey and I were still in high school, and we had our band, and they came to us and said, hey, you know, why don't we all get together and put a band, you know, a family band together? So Davey and I were like, yeah, why not? And there was that connection already. My older brothers had this connection with Richard Perry. So we started doing demos in our basement, just on a cassette. And we would go into Richard Perry's office. Richard Perry was a major producer at the time. He was producing Carly Simon. He produced Nielsen Schmilson, Ringo Starr, you know, Art Garfunkel. He was Barbra Streisand. He was a very big time guy. Wow. And we would go into his office and sit and wait for him to come through the door. And we go, Richard, we have another tape for you, you know, and just hand it to him. And then he would go back in his office and he'd play it on his cassette player. And then he'd open the door. Okay, guys, come on in. I want to talk to you, you know. And we would do that whenever we would write new songs. We would go into his office and hang out and wait for him to show up. We didn't even have an appointment. And he got us a record deal on ABC Records.
You said something earlier. It's funny because I was watching the Beach Boys documentary and Brian was talking about, you know, hearing the music on the radio for the first time. Uh-huh. But you right away were talking about, you know, the music and being part of TV, which has become such a big part of your path.
Yeah.
And Rose actually has some questions for you regarding this. But before we get into that, Milfredo, let's hear a bit of Stay the Night. Give us a little bit of background on that track, Tommy.
Yeah, that actually, we had done two albums on ABC, and then ABC was absorbed by Universal MCA Music. And so we lost our deal at that point. And we had a friend who was an engineer, Leslie Jones. She's actually the daughter of Spike Jones. And she was the staff engineer at ABC Studios. And she gave us time to go in, and we did a demo of Stay the Night, and that was presented to Polydor Records, and then they signed us for an album deal for Polydor. That was I like the demo better than the finished version, but we were able to have a top 50 record with that.
Unbelievable. And then obviously, you know, with success, doors are opening. And I'd like to welcome our co-host, Rose Ganguzo.
Hi, Tommy.
Hey, Rose.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
So going over your vast resume in this industry, I mean, you've obviously worked so many interesting people. I mean, don't even go near Ryan Murphy, who has resuscitated some of the best music from the past.
Absolutely.
And brought it into the mainstream today, mm-hmm. which is so fabulous for me.
Yeah.
But I was very curious about working with the director, Sylvester Stallone.
Oh, yeah.
On Staying Alive, which must have represented so many challenges for you, because you go from one of the most successful music-driven vehicles, which of course was Saturday Night Fever, into the long-awaited sequel.
Yeah.
And we then find out it's going to be directed by Sly Stallone. Mm-hmm. And I just want, and of course, the one track, We Dance So Close to the Fire, was of course one of the pivotal dance moments in the film. But mm-hmm. tell us a little bit about that experience and how you got involved in everything.
Yeah, I was signed to 20th Century Fox Publishing. And I was working with Andre Fisher, who was the former drummer of Rufus. In the Farragher Brothers, we were we were managed by Diana Ross's husband, Bob Ellis, who managed Rufus. So we did a lot of gigs with Rufus. We played at the Roxy, and we went on Soul Train with Rufus. So when I was shopping for a publishing deal, Andres got me signed to 20th. He remembered me from the Farragut Brothers. And I started working on artists' material, and I did a demo. I wrote this song with Randy Bishop called We Dance So Close to the Fire, and it was originally for my artist deal. At the same time, Sylvester Stallone was working on this, you know, follow-up to Saturday Night Fever, Staying Alive. And they had a song in this scene. John Travolta finally reaches the pinnacle of his career, and he goes on Broadway, and he's dancing to this Dante's Inferno show, jumping around in a loincloth and a headband, you know?
Yeah.
And they originally had a song sung by Sylvester Stallone's brother, Frankie Stallone, in this scene.
Yes.
And nobody liked it. It wasn't working. And so all of a sudden he put out the request for something that had to do with Dante's Inferno. And I had just happened to write this song called We Dance So Close to the Fire. And so my publisher sent it over to Paramount. And I just got this call. I was like, can you just show up at Paramount Studios, go to editing room so-and-so? And I, you know, I went there, and Sylvester Stallone opens the door, lets me in. He goes, oh, you know, we love your song. I got it. It's already... So I already synced it up to the film clip, you know, to the movie. And then he has this editing machine, and he shows me this scene of John Travolta jumping around on the stage. And they took my song and they sped it up to, you know, to the point where my voice sounded like Mickey Mouse. And he's dancing around, and they just edited it all together to make this long 7-minute version of a 3-minute song.
Right.
And so he said, you know, we love your song, but we need you to speed it up, and we need to recut it and make the bridge 10 times longer, you know. So then became this whole ritual of him coming to the studio. We're working at Pasha Studios on Melrose in Los Angeles. And, you know, he would show up with this huge entourage of people, big white limo. The door would open and he would come out. You know, ladies in fur coats and all this entourage of people come into the studio. He personally recorded my vocal on that song. And then when we finished, he asked me if I would be available to do another song on Lookout for Number One.
Right.
Which I had one day to prepare, and I went in the studio with Stuart Levine producing, and it was like a one-take deal. I nailed it, and that was it.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing. It's incredible.
Yeah, it was just all kind of accidental, you know, yeah. Like everything just kind of fell into place.
Have you ever had an experience with a director where they wanted to build a film around one song? Like they started with the song, and then because so much of what we see in trailers sometimes, where we'll see a song used in a trailer and then it never shows up in a film or whatever.
Yeah.
Directors get a little bit obsessive about music. What has your experience been?
Well, usually they have a placeholder, you know, and so they're looking for something that kind of fulfills the same emotional or tempo value, something that is important to them to accompany the scene. And, you know, and they get attached, and that's, you know, what I find is the attachment, it becomes so strong that you find yourself almost imitating what they were using to try to meet the requirements for the scene. And a lot of times they don't know exactly what they want, and they just got used to hearing that, you know, and it takes some convincing for them to understand that, you know, maybe, you know, there is something better than that, you know, or maybe this would fit. But I, you know, usually it's a case where they have the scene and they're looking for the music more.
Yeah. Yeah. I loved Glee because I thought it was so, it came into the landscape at a time when there was a lot of stale material around, and it was so refreshing. Mm-hmm. So one of the best series that's been done in most recent years has been Pose. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to know what your experience on that was. It's just such a wonderful piece. And a lot of people who were fans are sorry it's over.
Yeah. I worked on the Normal Heart for Ryan Murphy. And we did an a cappella version of the Gershwin song, The Man I Love.
Oh, wow.
And yes. And Ryan, you know, Ryan loved the way that came out. And, you know, he contacted me and said, you know, hey, this has a lot of emotional value to it. And I'm, you know, really love what you did. So when they came up with when they determined that they were going to complete Pose the series, and he wanted to do the finale, he wanted me to redo the Man I Love, which I did, and then add another song, you know, that had been used, that they were using, the gay men's chorus was using when someone would die from AIDS. And so it became very important, the emotional aspect of what was being presented, you know. So
it works, Tommy. It's beautiful the way you did it.
Recently I
did a film I produced remotely that had to do with AIDS. I was very involved with the AIDS movement and working with gay men's health crisis and everything in the time, mm-hmm. and did the first documentary about AIDS. So recently I did this film which really deals with the sort of orphans of AIDS. And I was talking to some people about it because it's about young people who had gotten AIDS from transfusions when they were younger and everything. And one of the foreign sales people that looked at the film says, you know, we absolutely love this film, but the subject matter isn't timely enough or something about, you know, AIDS not being important anymore, you know, because we're in mm-hmm. the middle of a pandemic. But I thought, oh my God, people are so what I loved about Pose is that it kind of brought that whole AIDS discussion back into the forefront, because it hasn't gone away.
No,
you know? It's still there and it's still with us. And you know, thanks to Ryan and Pose and Normal Heart and bringing up, you know, all these pieces again. You know, people are like, oh, what? Oh, yeah, there's that. You know,
yeah, kind of exactly. You know, it hasn't gone away, and we don't want to forget what happened. You know,
yeah, exactly. And for people of our generation, it's like, no, wait, you know, we remember what it was. I mean, I'm from New York. I live in New York. And it just decimated our entire Broadway community, entire creative community. I mean, all of my friends, you know, from Michael Bennett, like everybody who died from AIDS.
Yeah.
You know, it's not something you easily forget. And so that show really kind of reminded people, you know, of what that time was like.
Right. Yeah. I was living in New York too. I lived in New York for 30 years. So,
also being part of that. Were you part of the whole Brill Building?
No, but I'm a massive fan of the Brill Building.
Yeah.
Everything
that
happened.
What were those times like in New York for you in the music business? Those were pretty heady times.
Yeah. Well, I moved to New York in like about 87. 86, yeah. 87, and lived there for 30 years. And the music scene, the dance scene and the remix thing was big. I worked on a lot of remixes and I produced Brenda K. Starr and the Jets. And, you know, we did the Taylor Dane stuff. And, you know, I worked with the OJs, produced the OJs and Al Green. There was a lot of merging of, you know, rhythm dance music with pop and R&B at that time, you know.
Yeah. And how do you see a lot of this stuff coming back into the mainstream? I mean, because everything that's old is new.
Yeah.
Where do you see the crossover now?
Well, I think, you know, the state of the music business right now is kind of, to me, it feels like it's in limbo and it's looking for something, you know, like what's going to happen next. And I think, you know, all we can do as an honest and sincere musical person is just do what you do from the heart and do it well, you know. And that's just been, it's been kind of my MO the whole time, you know.
Right.
I chase things when I can, if it makes sense. But you know, for the most part, I like to fall back on my sense of what I believe is good and what I love, you know, what I like to listen to myself.
Yeah.
So, you know, sometimes something new will ring a bell and I'll go, oh man, that's great. You know, it's so funky, or it's so soulful, or what a great song, you know?
Yeah.
To me, it's always been about the song and kind of the groove of what the song, you know?
Right. So, I know, Jason, I'll probably want to jump in. I just wanted to ask the group what you thought of the 100 best songs list on Rolling Stone. There's a lot of big controversy about that list.
Oh, yeah. What was the number?
The greatest song was Respect.
Oh, right. Yeah. Hey, well, look at Otis Redding wrote that song. I'm down. That's good. Though I do, I did love Like a Rolling Stone by Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
One of the all-time favorite.
I was just actually going to say, before you start talking about Fried Green Tomatoes, maybe we should hear a little sample of something Tommy did for Glee. Wilfredo! Should we hear a little bit of Tommy's version of Silly Love Songs?
With silly love songs. And what's wrong with that?
We had to sneak it in. Arrangement, the vocals on that. I know Rose still has a question about Fried Green Tomatoes, but maybe Tommy, give us a little background on that.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because after we did that, Paul McCartney contacted the record company and said, why is it that Glee does a better version of my song than myself? And it was like, oh, can I use that? Then his publicist sent a note, you're not allowed to use that quote. So it was like, oh, shit, that's the best quote we could have had. He just spoke off the cuff, and then his publicist was like, oh, maybe you shouldn't say that.
So true. I mean, you killed it in that, and I had
Thank you.
That in. Sorry, Rose. Please, go ahead.
No. I'm loving this, because what I loved about Glee so much is you know, how it really brought back Broadway and their interpretations of some amazing songs from great Broadway musicals.
Yeah.
Did they bring you in on specific songs, or did you suggest songs as well?
Well, I came in originally to do Teenage Dream. And so, you know, because the background singers that they wanted to, they wanted a real a cappella group. So they had the Beelzebubs, who were in Boston, and I was on the East Coast. And so I got the call, can you take, you know, the Beelzebubs into the studio and work with them to come up with a version, an a cappella version of Teenage Dream? And we did a demo, and we still didn't have a lead singer. One of the guys in the Beelzebubs sang the lead. And so they sent me some audition tapes, and we had about 15 audition tapes, and Darren Criss was on there, and he sang a version of Bill Withers' Lean on Me. And out of all of the applicants, he was the one that had the most soulful, real kind of non-actor voice, you know, like he had a real music, you know, like radio kind of voice. And I said, you know, definitely this guy. And they were leaning towards him anyway. And literally the next day they flew him to New York. We went in the studio, cut the track. We stayed up almost all night mixing it, sent it to Ryan in the morning. A week later it was on the show, and it went through the roof. It just, you know, the video was released through some back channel way from the show, and the first day it had 300,000 views, and they knew it was going to be a big hit. Yeah. So then after that, then Ryan was like, can you do this one? We have another one for the Warblers. We want to feature the Warblers, because Darren was part of this group. Yeah, it was the Warblers. So he needed more vehicles to showcase Darren. So it became a whole thing of going up to Boston, doing backgrounds, coming back to New York, Darren flying to from Los Angeles to New York to do the lead. And then I started going back and forth from Los Angeles to do the leads.
How transformative was that? You had been in the music industry for so many years, and now all of a sudden you have a television vehicle that is driving records, well, not record sales, but downloads from Spotify. That was such a brilliant, very innovative way to bring the music to everybody.
Yeah, there was there was one point on the iTunes chart where I had four songs in the top five at the same time.
Exactly.
So, you know, and it was pre-streaming.
Yeah.
So they were literally buying the tracks, you know. And
exactly.
So, so you could actually make money then.
I mean, it's amazing to hear you talking about this, Tommy. It's just like, oh, no big deal. Just had 25 songs in the charts. Yeah, it happens.
That's so great. It's so great. So a little bit about Fried Green Tomatoes and what becomes of the Brokenhearted. I mean, how did that all come about?
Yeah, I was working with a producer, remixer in New York named Arthur Baker. And he was assigned to do the music for the soundtrack for Fried Green Tomatoes. And he called me up and said, hey, can you do a demo of What Becomes of the Brokenhearted? I really want to get Paul Young to do it. And I said, well, did Paul Young agree to do it? He goes, not yet. And I said, well, did the record company agree to do it? No, not yet. You know, so I did the demo. And then Arthur went to the record company and goes, hey, yeah, we got Paul Young wants to do this track, you know. But Paul Young hadn't even heard the song yet. Then he went back to Paul Young and he said, hey, the record company wants you to do this track. But the record company hadn't agreed to it yet. They were waiting for Paul Young, you know. So basically he was playing both sides at the same time. And the next thing I knew, we were doing the recording.
Very cool.
Yeah, and I basically took the original recording, you know, the original Motown recording and kind of added some Paul Young 4th C flavor in the keyboard part and, you know, to make it more appealing for Paul. And he loved it and he did a great vocal. We worked really hard on that vocal. It was like days and days of tweaking.
Right.
But it was worth it. It actually went to number one. So we're happy with that.
Milfredo?
Why don't we play a little bit of that? Take it from here.
How about we listen to that song, Milfredo?
The roots of love grow all around, but for me they come tumbling down. Every day heartaches grow a little stronger. I can't stand this pain much longer.
Brilliant, brilliant version of a song that honestly, I'd be scared to try and reimagine the songs that you've taken on. And like, you know, Paul McCartney says, I mean, you do it better than the original. Incredible.
Oh, thanks, man. Thank you.
Okay. So at one point, Tommy, you achieved something that most of us would think is the ultimate success, a top dance, top R&B, and top 100 single at the same time with one song, your song Under the Influence. Tell me what it was like working with Vanity and creating the album Skin on Skin.
Yeah, I got asked by Motown. I had been doing some stuff for Motown and working with this producer, Skip Drinkwater. And we got asked to produce a Vanity album and we met with her at Motown offices. She was as sweet as could be, the nicest person. We went into the studio. I wrote that Under the Influence with Robbie Neville. Basically, it was all about just trying to get her in the studio. You know, it was a thrill working with her. And I had to get together with Vanity numerous times at her apartment. And with keyboard, I'd set the keyboards up and we'd go through the songs. I'd look for the key signatures and get her on board in terms of what we were going to cut in the studio.
All right, so you started out on keys and synths, and I'm just wondering, you know, what are your favorite toys? What are your go-to instruments nowadays?
Oh, yeah. Well, my Prophet, a Juno 106. I still have my Rhodes and my Whirly. I still have my 808 drum machine. I still use all of my old stuff.
What's your take on analog versus digital? And would you ever use, would there ever be a scenario where you'd prefer like a hybrid?
Yeah. That's my go-to. The hybrid is actually exactly what I do. You know, I have a digital board. I have like an Allen and Heath board with that goes into the Mac. But then I have like a sidecar, like a Neve sidecar, and I have all my analog synths. And so, you know, the thing about the analog synths is that you can put your hand on it, you can turn the knob, and it's a real sound. It's not a picture of the sound.
Tommy, incredible answers. Thank you for sharing this insight. Oh,
my pleasure.
Our songwriters and musicians just eat that stuff up. And I do want to end with talking about actually TV production, but I want to also say to you in the audience, please raise your hand. Eric's going to let people on stage if you have a question for Tommy. Also want to point out Rachel has joined our stage. Eric, I saw your mic was open. I don't know if you have a question or a comment for Tommy.
Oh, no, this has been a great interview. Hey, Tommy, this has just been awesome. I was just flashing on the analog plugin comment that, yeah, all the digital stuff, no matter what you have, the most popular plugins are all analog. But it's really, really cool to hear all the questions you guys have been asking, just passing around from Jason to Rose. So I love that. The interview format has been really just great to listen to, and just hearing going from your career of talking through your, you know, the music industry, and then having the access to take that into sync, and just the vast array of experiences has been really amazing to listen. So thank you.
Thank you so much, man.
And Tommy, just so you know, Eric is a skilled musician that, you know, his focus is all on sync. He does some incredible tutorials. He has a room of his own here. So yeah, fantastic for you guys to connect. And
great.
Thank you for that, Eric.
Absolutely.
Jason, if I could just, hi, Tommy, it's Milfredo.
Hey, man, how you doing?
Hey, man, how you doing? Yeah, good, thank you. I just wanted a quick one, a bit of advice, really, if I'm being a bit selfish. But so on Every Beat of My Heart, and I know you work with Arthur Baker and Lottie Golden on that, didn't you? Yeah,
yes.
And from I've always been a bit in awe of the proper songwriters like yourself, but you know, Arthur Baker with Breaker's Revenge and things like that, I'm just wondering how the writing process goes with someone who's coming from that kind of high energy. And I mean, they were kind of pioneers of the electro hip hop scene, you know, back in the early 80s.
Yeah.
And I'm often working with proper songwriters, and I'm on eggshells sometimes. And I wonder how the process would work with someone like those two, you know, and yourself.
Yeah, usually in a situation like that, either Arthur would come to me and say, hey, we need something that has this type of a groove. And I go, oh, what do you mean? He go, oh, the bass, like a boom, 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 you know. He would sing something like that, and I go, oh, okay. And I go over to the keyboard and I would play it out, and he goes, yeah, yeah, okay. And just like a straight four kick drum against it, okay. And then I go over to the drum machine and I pound that out, you know. But then it became, you know, okay, that's not the whole song. We need chords, we need movement, you know. We need a top line, we need a melody, we need a lyric, you know. So
but
it would be an inspirational, hey, we need something like this, or play a track, like a dance track that was popular at the time, or something from the past. And reference for a song, you know, and then it would be about, you know, writing a proper song over the top of it.
But
with someone like Arthur, you know, he had his own recording studio, Shakedown. So he would have, like in the case of Taylor Dayne, pretty much the song was mostly written when he came in on that song. But he had a couple of ideas, and he also had access to Rick Wake, who was Taylor Dayne's producer, who was working at his studio. And he actually took a cassette and gave it to Rick. And then a week later, Rick came back and Arthur said, "Hey, did you get a chance to listen to With Every Beat of My Heart?"
Right.
And Rick goes, "What? What are you talking? I don't even understand. You know, why would you give me this cassette?" And Arthur looks at the cassette. "Oh, man, you listened to the wrong side." He flipped the cassette over and he goes, "Oh, shit, I love this song." And he gave it to Clive Davis. So, you know,
perfect.
But I mean, there's a case, yeah, if you didn't follow up, that would never have happened. You know,
no, just let it go. That's right. Oh, yeah. Cool. I'm forever singing bass lines to, like, you know, proper songwriters, and they kind of look at me like I'm mad. But in my head, I know exactly what I'm trying to get out. But you know, that's a good insight. Okay, thank you very much, man.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Incredible. I love that feeling. Thank you, Milfredo. Well, look, Tommy, we have just a little bit more time, and I have to ask you about Pop Stars, this Australian hit TV show. And from what I'm reading about online, if it wasn't for that show, there wouldn't be an American Idol. And you're an executive producer on this show.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, when I got the call to do the show, I flew to Australia from New York. It was like a 25-hour trip. They picked me up at the airport. They brought me into the recording studio. And the girls were the group is called Bardot. They were all in the lounge playing pool. I walked around. They introduced me to everyone in the show, in the group. And then all of a sudden, the director yells, "Cut, cut, cut!" And he goes, "Can you go back outside and come back in and pretend like you never met these people and do this all over again?" Because the lighting was bad. And basically, that was the show for me. For the next like 6 months, my whole life was being filmed on this TV, and I was a part of the show. I was on the show, and I produced the album. The album went to number one, and the first single went to number one. And Chris Moss, who was the head of Warner's at the time in Australia, asked me if I would come to the United States, take all the tapes of the show and the album and everything, and see if I could shop the concept to labels in the US. And they had a right of first refusal for any Atlantic label. So it had to be Atlantic labels. So I went to, you know, I went to Elektra Asylum, I went to Atlantic, I went to all the affiliates of Atlantic and tried to shop the deal, and everybody turned it down. And everybody said, literally, the argument was a show on TV trying to sell music would never work. What works in Europe or in Australia would not work in the United States. And a year later, you know, but I did do a meeting with David Foster, and David Foster was like, "Yeah, I like this idea. I think this could work." And he came up with his own version of it and released it the next year. But it was basically it was the show that spawned American Idol. It was executive produced by Simon Fuller and was a massive hit in Australia.
Unbelievable, Tommy. What a career, from being an artist in a band and charting to creating the most memorable syncs in major films, carving out a television history. You've done it all. And to have you here with us tonight is just such an honor. Thank you, Tommy. Before we let you go, I just want to open it up to the stage. Rachel, I see you're flashing. Do you want to say hello?
Yeah. Hi. Thanks, Jason. Hey, Tommy. Nice to meet you. This has been so fascinating to hear your stories.
Oh, thank you.
Just going back to hearing about your family and stuff, I would just have so many questions, but it's been an honor. And just the analog conversation, and Jess, what a great question about keys. I was like, oh, I think he's asking that for me. So that was really cool. And so thank you for that. Just one quick question for you. I work with a lot of indie artists who are just getting their foot in the door. They have songs, they're working on their craft, and they want to get their music into TV, film, and ads. Do you have any kind of words of wisdom for people who are just starting out?
Just, you know, basically write the best songs you can. Don't necessarily look to the most contemporary things. I mean, use them as guides for what people are, you know, might want to use. But remember that there's a whole, you know, group of music and things from the past that need to be regurgitated and, you know, Like now I'm listening more to older material, you know, Lester Young and Duke Ellington, and listening to old stuff, because just the level of musicianship and the level of musical creativity is so high. You know, I think the pandemic kind of opened up the opportunity to take a look back in time and revisit all this old music. And Spotify is like, the even though they're not paying us, that, you know, there is an aspect to it that's pretty amazing, where you can go on and just, you can, oh, I want to listen to the old John Coltrane record from 1959, and you immediately find it. So, I mean, it's just so much material. And I think what really touches people is when you have something that's rooted in something that's honest and sincere and real. And people really need that, you know, people need to be able to relate to something. It's easy to just kind of take what's out there right now and try to imitate it. Like we were talking about the hybrids of recording, there's, you know, hybrid musically too. Like I love that Diazepam song that you played at the beginning. When I hear that, I hear I hear the guitar part, you know, it's got a rootsy feel to it. Mm-hmm. I hear where he's coming from. I can hear what he's touching on, those influences. You know, if there's a Prince, or there's somebody, an R&B artist from the 60s or the 70s, or, you know, like you can hear it being brought into the new era. And I think that's really important.
Tommy, would you say to strive for timeless?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Timeless, honest, emotional. We want to communicate, you know, we want to communicate with people. Right now, it's so auto-tune driven, it's so computer driven, that it's really about producers' music. It's not as artists, because how do you know what the artist even sounds like if their voice is so affected? And so right now, I think that's what's happening right now. But will it in 5 years? I don't know. You know, I don't know. Will there be a backlash and people will want to hear just kind of honest singing and even like hitting a flat note here and there, you know? But if you listen to Stevie Wonder records, there were many mistakes on those records, technically, you know, many. But those mistakes became the thing that brought you the beauty of it, you know? Yeah. So we become, I mean, we're always self-correcting now, you know, we're correcting everything.
It's too much. It is too much.
Thank you, Rachel.
As you can tell, Rachel's an incredible musician. She actually has created a powerful support community for musicians called Peer Support.
Oh,
has
cool.
A brilliant room she does here. Yeah, she's wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dave, welcome to the stage. Do you have a question for Tommy?
Tommy? I had to giggle at your comments about analog versus digital. I was just on a Clubhouse call with Eric and Daraz just yesterday, and I said that next month I turn 66 years old, and I'm still having a problem. Where do you put the needle on an MP3? Now, people are always asking me, when they don't know who I am, what kind of music do you play? And I always respond, it's not about the music, baby. It's about the hair. The music's got to go with the hair. You know what I mean?
Hey, I've been there.
I'm a huge fan of Memphis, Sun Records specifically, but Stax Records as well, and High Records from the 70s.
Yeah.
So you were definitely talking my language when you set out Green and Otis Redding. Just wanted to thank you for being here and sharing your thoughts.
Thank you.
Jay, I just submitted a song for the TV show, so I got to go off because I got a paying gig. So God bless y'all. Be good.
Oh, yeah. Thanks,
have a great
David.
Show, Dave.
Thank you, man.
Mark, welcome back to the stage. Great to have you as always. You got a question for Tommy?
Thank you, Jason. Thanks. Thanks, Tommy. This has been great.
Thanks, man.
It's nice to meet you. And I'm 62 myself, a sax player from the beginning. I was just wondering if you, man, I sure hope the analog stuff's coming back and the real horns and the real music. I mean, you mentioned some of my heroes in jazz, and what's your experience with that? What's your vibe on it? Do you think it is coming back? I've been hearing some people say, you know, I've been getting briefs asking for horns, which is really exciting.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's definitely coming back.
Yes.
It's definitely coming back.
Bring it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool, don't give up hope. Don't give up hope, Mark. We love brass.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, I like all the other stuff, too. And, you know, you can do a lot with the computer, but yeah, man, it's nothing like the real deal. My songs I wrote with Tower of Power that got a couple top number one Billboard records out of it. That's my claim to fame. And
oh man, which songs?
Oh, they're on the new ones, the last two releases. So you probably wouldn't know the names of, but it's on the last two records. You know, they debuted at number one
That's fantastic.
Exciting for me.
Congratulations, man. That's great. Nice. Yeah, the Farragher brothers, we played with Tower of Power in like 1976. Yeah, we did a bunch of gigs with them.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I love this. Cool, only on Clubhouse. Man. Yeah, that is incredible. How cool, Mark.
Yeah, some guys I write with are like, who?
Yeah, that's fun.
Icons.
Man, you need to get alive.
Yeah.
Excellent. I don't want to take up any more time. Thanks so much, Tommy.
All right. Thank you, Mark. Nice talking to you.
All right. Peace.
Roy, welcome to the stage. Do you have a question for Tommy?
Hey, Roy.
Hi, Roy.
Oh, my goodness. Hey, Tommy. How are you?
Hey, man. Good.
It has been so many years.
Yeah, it has.
And I just want to say, since we met back in the 70s, I've been a big Farragher Brothers fan. You and all your brothers, I think you guys are just amazing. And
it's thanks, really great man. To Thank hear you.
On this program.
Yeah, I still think about the first time you came over to my house and we were jamming.
Ah, awesome. We did a lot of awesome things at MCA and with Michael Caruso.
Yeah, that's right. You were part of that world, man.
Tommy, this has been so amazing, but feel free to stay if you have the time as we roll into the second hour and get into the sync opportunities. Kevin's going to announce which track he chose for the tech company and his promo video. We have a couple of new exciting things to announce as well, but I think we'll go into our smoke break song. This is an independent songwriter called Sarah Gargano and her song Wonder.
I'll make friends, won't let them ever slip away. a new home when I'm alone. I'll still feel okay in London. In London. In London. In London. In London.
Hey guys.
Hey Jace.
Hey Jason. You okay?
Yeah, I'm good. Just buried in paperwork.
Oh, for the sync report.
Not this time. Move Me No Mountain.
That indie film your music supervising?
Yeah.
Sounds like a great project. What's the problem?
It's a brilliant film and we're building a great soundtrack, but you can't imagine how much paperwork I deal with for these films.
Have you heard of Sync Lodge?
First, you got to draft up the sync request forms.
I've heard of Sync Lodge.
Then drafting and issuing contracts.
Yep, Sync Lodge is great, Paula. It does everything a music supervisor needs.
Then deliver the cue sheet. It never ends.
Doesn't Sync Lodge do all of that automatically?
Sweat Lodge? What are you guys banging on about? I got real issues I'm sharing with you guys.
Yeah, lots of issues.
We're trying to tell you, Jason. Sync Lodge is a new platform for music supervisors. It helps you to source the music, sync songs against scenes, draft up sync requests, and even creates the cue sheets once you've locked in the music to the film.
Oh, Sync Lodge does all that?
It's true, Jason. I just started using it for the sync report, and it's not only saving time, but it's so easy to use, I'm actually enjoying the work.
You guys are the best. Sync Lodge sounds amazing and exactly what I need for music supervising. Why am I always the last one to hear about these things?
I've been telling you about Sync Lodge for weeks.
Don't feel bad, Edge, for not telling me sooner. I know you're busy. You're a good guy.
Paula, is my mic on? Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, Edge.
Guys, what's the name of that program again?
Sync Lodge.
That is something to scream about. Yes, you too can be cool like Edge and use cutting-edge technology to help you with your film and TV productions. No matter if you're a music supervisor, director, producer, editor, save time and increase proficiency with Sync Lodge.
I need to find a new gig.
Sync opportunities, sync opportunities.
So I think this is our last Christmas song search for the Sync Report holiday special. All right, let me welcome my amazing cast and crew before we start playing the music. Let's start with gorgeous Lisa Dunn, who actually every week is organizing these playlists for Name That Soundtrack. She's helping us with the script. She does all the research. She's an incredible writer. She's one of my dearest of friends. Hello, Lisa Dunn.
Thank you, Jason. Thanks for reading the script I wrote for you to say about me.
No, hey, I do as I'm told. I'm so scared of the strong women in my group.
I write my own intros.
And that is a total lie. I did that.
That is a total lie.
All right, getting serious. Lisa Dunn, thank you for transposing the holiday special into final draft as we like get professional. The scripts are even becoming professional. My goodness.
I feel very professional now.
Yeah, doesn't it feel? It just feels like everything's kind of stepped up a level for us. It's insane. I'm not quite sure. I hope it doesn't ruin our rebellious, chaotic flow. But Kevin's insisting we get professional. So ultimately, the director is the boss. We got to do what the boss says. And thank you, Lisa, for helping us qualify. All right, moving on. Not that I could spend all day talking with Lisa. Jody, where are you? Are you at home? What's going on in your world?
Things are going good. Looking forward to all the stuff going on with the Sync Report. And got some music projects that are moving along.
Jody, I can't wait to hear all of these songs.
Thank you.
let's talk with Phil, the meanest guy on the team. Hi, Phil. How are you doing, you?
I'm good. Thank you. I'm very good. I'm very, very happy because my children are home. So I'm ecstatic. Oh. First time we've been together since Christmas, which is just brilliant. We're now, August? So
amazing. I've had OG's there?
OG, yeah. And my daughter, Eva. They're both musos and singers and songwriters. songwriters just like the old man, you know, so it's great to have them here. The house is noisy again, and I've had my family round, and it's been absolutely brilliant day. So it's 9:15 here for me, so just winding down. It was just nice to come and relax with you guys, and great finish to a great day. So I'm all good. I'm all happy and bubbly. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you for taking a pause from the family to spend time with us. That's amazing.
Well, you know, there's a limit to how much I can stand them, to be honest. So, you know, it's nice to see them, but, you know, just in small doses, you know. So, yeah, of course, couldn't wait to get out of there. So, yeah.
That's why we played I Drink Alone at the top of the hour. So before we move on to the panel, I see the queen herself is here joining us. I don't know. She could be in France. She could be in Amsterdam. I have no idea where the Learjets brought her this week. Paula Flack, how are you?
Well, we're in Amsterdam at the moment. It's been a hectic few days here.
Well, hey, whenever you're stressed, it's good to be in Amsterdam, because I'm sure...
Except I'm sure for your children.
Have you given the kids brownies then?
No.
Yeah, come on.
If only. Oh my God.
Well, you're definitely having French fries with mayonnaise, I'm sure.
We've had French fries with mayonnaise, lots of stroopwafel and I don't know, other stuff.
What is stroopwafel?
Syrup waffle.
Oh, you've really made yourself at home in Amsterdam.
I have. I've learned a few words.
I love it. I love your style. And of course, you are the producer of the TV show itself. So you better get home soon, because there is a buttload of work waiting for you, woman.
I'm ready. I'm waiting. Can't wait. Get my claws in.
Excellent. Hello, Heather. How you doing, beautiful?
Hello. I'm doing good. I'm a little sad because my sister left Canada for Iceland, but I'm going to join her next week. So.
Oh, wow. Oh, so you're going back to Iceland. That's like a regular spot for you.
Yeah. You know, just like stay at my grandma's and like eat a lot of stuff from the bakery. And then when friends visit, they're like, show me the Golden Circle. And I'm like, oh, I hate doing tourist stuff.
Yep. Heather, I'm so glad you're part of this team. And yeah, everybody on the team, you know, you guys know we're working on contracts for everybody because this new deal is happening. And it's all becoming official. So it's very, very exciting. All right. Now we're going to fade in smoothly into the listening session. But before we do, we have to say hello to two of the most brilliant minds I'm able to call my friends as far as production, music, song is considered. And I'm going to start with Vinx. Hello, Vinx.
Oh, I thought you were skipping my ass. I said, oh, wait.
No way. I was never. I saved the best for last year.
I love you with so much negritude. You're just a beautiful man. I appreciate you so much. I am in Baltimore, and I have not got tased yet. Life
is
good.
That's right. You got back to the States again. How is that going?
I can't wait to get out of here. I leave Monday. I leave tomorrow. But I've seen some great, great, great friends. And it's actually great because I was able to get food that you can't get in France, you know.
Oh, that's good. Well, that's the thing. We do kind of miss, you know, that, you know, the
Frito-Lays.
Yeah, the stuff we grew up on, and how great that you're enjoying the experience. And I'm so glad that you haven't been tased yet.
No, I'm all good, guys. I just love being able to reach in and talk to you and put some love on y'all. And you always remind me that none of us are alone. And I appreciate that.
Oh, I love you, Vinx. I hope you're ready for some holiday music. We're going to be listening to it tonight.
Yeah, but Milfredo's back, so he's going to talk a lot of shit, and I know it. I'm ready.
Well, that was the thing I did. I saved the most gorgeous, most beautiful, most brilliant of my friends for last. Milfredo!
No festivals. No festivals this week. Just I had a screw in my shoulder on Friday, if that's anything to... I can't say I've been tased, but I've had a new screw in my shoulder for my accident. So that's as good as I can get, mate. But
oh, my God. Yeah. Well... So you are slowly becoming the $6 million man.
Oh, man. Very quickly. Not slowly. Quickly. The older the older I get, the better I was. But
How are you feeling?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. Like a bit like Phil. The kids are home. But unlike Phil, it's become quite clear why spiders eat their young. I understand it now completely. Jesus Christ.
Well, I'm with you, no Friday.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So let us do this. Paula Flack, who is the first songwriter musician, submitter that we will torture on our stage.
Our first song is called Red and White. Red and White Looks Good on You by Lisa Williams. And she's on stage ready after we've heard it.
Excellent. Milfredo.
Play it, Milfredo.
I think that red and white looks good on you. Dancing underneath the mistletoe, do what we do. With the lights on, getting all groove on. I think that red and white looks good on you. You, good on you. You. Hey, pretty baby, I've been waiting all year. Hear those jingle bells and some holiday cheer. So won't you slip in something nice? I can't believe my eyes. You've given me the best gift I could ask for all year. I think that red and white looks good on you. Dancing underneath the mistletoe, do what we do. With the lights on, getting all groove on. I think that red and white looks good on you. You, good on you. You. Hey, baby, let's roll in the new year. Count down to the good times that go far field. Let's raise a glass of champagne, baby. Make it rain. You've given me the best gift I could ask for all year. I think that red and white looks good on you. Dancing underneath the mistletoe, doing what we do. With the lights on.
What a voice. Wow, Lisa. It has. It's funny because Paula was just texting me back channel, and I was going to say the same thing. It kind of is like almost if Tracy Chapman was going to do a Christmas song.
Yeah.
It is just gorgeous. I love it. Please give us a little insight.
Yeah, that's kind of what John Semenio and I wrote that song. And that was kind of the vibe I was going for, like the Tracy Chapman.
You nailed it.
Give me one reason, you know?
Yeah.
So, I was so blessed and happy that John wanted to work with me and kind of came together with Eric. You know, we were writing some stuff for him, and it just turned out great. I was really happy with it, and I'm just so proud of that song.
Well, you did an incredible job. And I'm let's open it up. Vinks, I'd love to hear what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I was just taking it in and thinking about it. And it's really difficult for me because, you know, I toured so much with Taj Mahal. So the blues and the thing is, it's a little different for me, but I appreciate it. You know what they're trying to do. I didn't feel the Christmas in it, but I like the song. I like the attempt and what they're trying to go for, and there's some clever lyrics and all that. But bravo, man, because that's a good thing about what we do is everybody's not supposed to get it. That's what makes it special for those who do.
Thank you.
And it's funny, Vinks, because to be honest, it's the songs that don't sound Christmassy at all that I've been really flipping over. Was so far from what we're used to for Christmas time, but still, because of the lyric, you know, it kind of brought us there. But yeah, I hear what you're saying. I definitely hear what you're saying. Milfredo, what'd you think?
Yeah, I love the alternative husky voice. Do you know what it needs to be? If it did ever come out, it's a Liverpool terrace anthem, I think. Red and white looks good on you. It might be a new substitute for You'll Never Walk Alone or something, but it's definitely a terrace anthem. But
a football anthem.
Yeah, wow. Red and white. Yeah. But a commercial dream for sure. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you know, you get those alternative kind of John Lewis takes on stuff, but I could see that. I love the warm chords. And what Vince was just saying about the Christmas, at the end, ironically, I was just thinking, yeah, this just needs some festive bells or something. I know it's so obvious, but they were just in there. And I reckon just to twist the Christmas 0 to 10 button up a little bit, I reckon if they were just brought up in the mix a smidgen, not too much, so it's so obvious, but that would just Christmas it up a little bit. And then, but I was hoping there was that next level, you know, that it started off quite acoustic and then in it came. And then there was like a third level chorus, I think, with a tambourine percussion lift came in. And you've got to have a key change on a festive tune, and boom, there it was. And you even snuck in, I think I heard, jingle bells at the end of that, like, fourth chorus. Was that, am I right? Did you just sneak
a little? You're right. Yeah.
And it was good. I liked it. It was just in and it was gone again. It was just a nice touch. I loved it. I just think it's a great alternative to, you know, the obvious sort of Christmas tune. So, yeah, good work.
Thank you very much. I appreciate
that. Is that you singing, Lisa?
It is, yes.
Wow, what a voice. You are incredible.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
And funny thing, just a little sidebar, Tracy Chapman almost didn't release Give Me One Reason, but her manager, Ron Stone, talked her into it. And thank God he did, because what a great song and huge hit that was for her.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. Excellent, Lisa. Well, you know, I know you've been on the stage before. I hope you continue to submit, because I am in love with your voice.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you guys very much. Thanks for the feedback. I appreciate it.
Brilliant. We are on fire. Let's keep it rolling. Paula Flack, who is the next victim?
I love the way you call them all victims.
Well, getting on this stage, not only do you have to have big balls, but yeah, to listen to me, my God, God bless you for just, yeah, and I hate a penny for you too. All right. Talk to me, Paula.
Silent Night cover by Diana St. Hilaire and Caroline Hillmore. Play it, Milfredo.
What a lovely interlude. What is that? The harpsichord, some wonderful sounds. Yeah, incredible. Caroline, introduce yourself. Talk to me about that track.
Hi, Jason. Hi. Thank you so much. We are so excited that y'all played our song. This is such a great room. There's so much talent in it. And we're just so excited to be here. Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, well, welcome. We love that you're enjoying the room and we're enjoying your song. So tell me, was that the harpsichord I'm hearing? What was the inspiration? What's the production? What did you do?
Well, Diana and I have been collaborating on cinematic pop, and she's an artist and a producer, and she composes, and I'm a composer, mix engineer, do all those things. And we usually go a little dark with our cinematic pop songs, almost on the verge of being trailers. And so last year, we were like, let's try to do a cool version of Silent Night. In the middle, we felt like there needed to be a percussion coolness, and just to give it a lift. And then at the end, we added, I think there were just some kind of bells that we found that we modified by EQing them. But we just love having fun. So it was something that was super fun for us to try. And we actually are going to work on a couple of more Christmas songs. We're going to explore the possibilities. So we just are thankful for this platform. And Diana can't be here today, but she sends her best to everyone and says thank you to all the guest speakers.
Oh, wonderful. All right. Well, it's great because I always love getting instrumentals. Those are really quite easy for us to use. Vinx, go ahead. What did you think of that track?
Man, first off, I thought it was perfect. You know, I mean, my head goes to the place, and she was clearly ice skating, and it was a beautiful music, but she was ice skating on Jimmy Choo skates, you know, so it had a whole other elegance to it, and she was doing all the turnaround, splitting the thing. It was beautiful, you know, and yeah. And I just stayed on the side with my Birkenstock because I'm black and I don't skate well.
Thanks, Vinx. That's
awesome. Wait till you see Vinx for the holiday special. You're actually part of the ice skating bonanza. So we're going to see Vinx on ice pretty soon. Milfredo, what did you think of that track?
At the start, the clinky clonkies, and then it like morphed into Silent Night. I like that. It sounded like one of my mashups. It's just like I wasn't expecting it, and then in it came. I was waiting for the vocal, but it was quite refreshing that there was. It's kind of like, I don't know, synth sound Xmas meets The Abyss. Do you know that? It's like the big, imagine that on The Abyss, like a Christmas version of The Abyss or something, where they go underwater. And then there's this discovery, this enlightenment of this whole new world. So I could hear it as like a cinematic piece, to be honest with you. I wanted some mad Silent Night vocal to come in, if I'm honest, but it didn't arrive. But yeah, I like the big sounds is what I liked about it. But I was just waiting for that next element for me, and it didn't arrive. And I don't know whether it needed like a bit of a juxtaposed synth coming in, like a, you know, something electronic or something. I don't know. But
no,
yeah.
See, for me, it's funny. I would have liked it to gone even more so in that, like, you know, the 1700, you know, very, you know, she was, you know, with that, the harpsichord, like
green yeah. sleeves kind of thing. Yeah.
Right, just yeah, like, yeah, yeah. You know, but it was interesting how she mixed those sounds. So, yeah, very cool. Phil, talk to me. What did you think of that track?
But, yeah, I loved it. I took the words out of my mouth. It's funny, I was waiting for it also to go up another notch. And it was interesting that Caroline said they normally work on darker material, so it's nice to do a light version of this. And I was actually hoping it would go a bit dark, you know, a bit minor, Caroline. So maybe I think you can just turn it up to 11, another notch. And maybe, like Jason said, go vintage, go, you know, old punk with it, and just take it a dark notch. It almost felt like you were going to go into like a horror score for me. I was hoping it was going to go that way, but I loved it. I liked the orchestration. I liked, again, I was expecting vocal as well. So it was a nice surprise that it wasn't, but I think I would stick on a really weird, crazy instrument and just bring it up to, you know, a whole nother level. Once you've got to the point where you got to, when we finished listening to it, it could just go that extra notch, maybe with, you know, choirs and, you know, full on orchestration, something really sinister, just to make it really stand out from the norm. But yeah, I loved it. Great job.
Yeah, that's a good shout, Phil. Like the choir is almost like Omen-esque, isn't it? It just needs to go down that route. Yeah, yeah, good shape. Yeah.
Thank you so much, because I've worked on horror films and she's done some really cool vocals on some other stuff. So I think we could ramp it up. I just appreciate this great you know, and positive input. Thank you.
And you know, to be honest, for me, what I would almost do is I would get the stems and just use that harpsichord for, you know, some backing sounds for the show. Excellent. Okay, like, thank you. I hope we hear some of your more spooky, haunty stuff. So continue to submit. In the next couple of weeks, we're going to be opening up some new submissions for film and TV. Thank God we're almost done with this Christmas in July. What are we, in August? Christmas in August, which is just so unruly. Brilliant. We are on fire. Let's keep it rolling. Paula Flack, who is the next victim?
I love the way you call them all victims.
Well, getting on this stage, not only do you have to be have big balls, but yeah, to listen to me, my God, God bless you for just, yeah, and I ain't a penny for you too. All right. Yeah. Talk to me, Paula.
Well, the next brave soul to come on stage is G Putnam, and we're going to hear his song Crush on Christmas. Play it, Mulfredo.
Okay, that's my sister's anthem right there. That is so Stacey Rothberg. Stacey, Dr. Stacey Montgomery. That is ridiculous. Greg, introduce yourself. Tell us a bit about that track.
I'm very pleased to be with y'all, first of all. I'm from a place they call Normal, and I'm trying to fit in. but while we're here, we actually wrote a Christmas song last year called Come On Christmas. We got done with the song. We're talking about doing another Christmas song. We came up with a few good lines, and then we stopped and said, we got to come up with a really cool, different idea. And so we made Christmas into a character, so to speak, and did a romance tune to Santa, basically, or Christmas itself. And the hook was, of course, Crush on Christmas. And we came up with that before we finished the song, of course. But it was just made up in the studio.
What fun. Definitely a fun track. Positive. Obviously, you're a fan of Christmas. We can feel it in the music. Vinx, what did you think of that track?
You know me. I loved it. It was, man... I was happy. I loved the way you twisted and maybe made Christmas the character.
Okay. Yeah, we were really reaching for a younger audience and really the happiness because
it worked. The happiness was perfect, man. Greg, the happiness, you touched it right. And I was trying to imagine what product would grab a hold of that thing at Toys R Us, and it'd be the happiest thing you could do is get that new Barbie thing, and then there's a new version of Ken or whatever, you know. I don't know. It fits so perfectly in that, the joy of it and the twist of the relationship.
Well, thank you.
What fun. Thank you to everybody in the audience tonight. The energy's been electric. Vinks, Milfredo, Phil, your commentary, always spot on. Honestly, I just can't believe that we have such incredible, prolific commentary coming from this panel regarding these songs. Actually, incredible. What a room we are hosting. Thank you, Paula, for the introductions. Lisa and Heather for coordinating the music with us tonight. Jody Lynn for everything that you do. Oh my God, do I adore you. What a team. And Kev, we miss you, Kev. I know you're on the road. We hope the move's going well. We love you. We miss Super Kev. We all call him Super Kev. Thank you to everybody for joining us every Sunday for the Sync Report. Our audience, who's not our audience, you're our community. Your brothers and sisters, all connected through creativity. And it's such an honor to have you guys part of our life. Thank you so much. Join us again next Sunday and continue to send us brilliant music. Thanks again to all the members of our the Sync Report cast and crew. You guys are absolutely brilliant, and it is an honor to work with you on a daily basis. I love you guys. Have a wonderful Sunday. Thank you and good night.
Thank you so much to our amazingly talented guests for joining us on today's show and to you, our listeners, for spending your time listening to us and being with us. The Sync Report cast will be back in a week with your hosts, myself, Colin O'Donoghue, Rose Ganguza and Jason P. Rothberg. Until next time, take care and be kind.
Thank you for listening. Tune in next week.
Today's episode was produced by Jason P. Rothberg, Kevin Sharpley, Paula Flack, and Robert Capadonna. It was written by Jason P. Rothberg, Kevin Sharpley, Lisa Dunn, and Paula Flack. Editing was by Jason P. Rothberg, Milfredo Seven, Paula Flack, Edgar Edge Kamei, and Adam McNamara. Research by Lisa Dunn. Graphic design by Jody Lynn Talevi. Brought to you by Zabatar.